This is the November 19 edition of Commodity Week.
Todd Gleason's services are made available to WILL by University of Illinois Extension.
Welcome to Commodity Week. I am Todd Gleason. Our panelists for the day include Dave Chatterton of Strategic Farm Marketing, Dale Durkles of Grain Cycles, and Wayne Nelson of L&M Commodities. Our special guest for the day is Dan Bossi. He's at Ag Resource Company. Commodity Week is a production of Illinois Public Media. You may find and listen to the whole of the program anytime you'd like on our website. The address there is willag.org. That's willag.org. One other website you should visit and do it right now, farmdocdaily.illinois.edu. That's farmdocdaily.illinois.edu. You know, each and every December I travel, usually, with the agricultural economist from the University of Illinois on the Illinois Farm Economic Summits to five cities across the state of Illinois. Well, that's not going to happen this year, and instead, starting December the 1st and running on Tuesdays and Fridays for five in a row, Tuesday, Friday, and then Tuesday the 15th of December, we'll host five one-hour meetings on Zoom, and you can join them. They're at 11 o'clock on those days, but you need to register. There are more than 600 registered already, and we're going to run out of seats soon enough. If you'd like to join the Ag Economist and me, you can do that at farmdocdaily.illinois.edu. Look for the IFES, I-F-E-S, webinar link. Now, let's begin our conversation. Dan Bossi, thank you for being here from Ag Resource Company in Chicago. What have you been up to so far this early winter meeting season?
Well, it's been a lot of discussing to people how the markets change so quickly in a matter of a month or two, and trying to then strategize and get them to have their head around a different marketplace for the upcoming year. It's been a long time, Todd, since we had a demand driver, but when we lost about 60 million metric tons of corn and soybeans in the U.S. and had some problems in the Black Sea in terms of the Ukrainian crop, it's kind of looking like we're getting the trifecta of U.S. losses, Black Sea losses, and now we've got problems in South America. And just making sure the farm community is in the right risk category and they're participating in this rally is what we're trying to do.
Can I ask, how long did it take you to get your head into that space?
I got there probably a month later than I would have liked to, Todd. I would have loved to have been there right after the August crop report, but it really took me until the middle of September after that September stocks report to really say, hey, this is different and we need to react. This is my 41st year of doing this. I've never seen an agricultural market change so quickly from one schematic to the next, or bear to bull in this case. And so for me, it was kind of like we needed to get on this. And thankfully we did. But, you know, it was trying.
What was it that made it difficult?
I think it was this probability of the late summer drought in combination with trying to understand what China was going to buy for corn. You know, as you think about corn and soybeans that the Chinese were taking, the soybeans were kind of expected in balance sheets. They already had 28 or 29 million metric tons grilled in the USDA balance sheet, but they didn't have the corn. And then the USDA kept holding on to this TRQ argument, saying, hey, we haven't got this official estimate from the Chinese yet, so we're doubtful about their corn imports. And so if you looked at Chinese stock data, as we do, and believed what USDA had put out, it didn't make sense that the Chinese would really be stepping up as much corn as they do. But I think we now understand the Chinese are probably on a trajectory to take, we think, 24 to 28 million metric tons in the year ahead. And with that, there's an outside chance that U.S. corn exports could make it up to 3 billion bushels. That's really going to tighten up stocks. And, you know, that along with South American weather problems are what the market will be about over the next 4 to 6 weeks.
Hey, Dale Durkles, two things. I'd like you to go ahead and ask a question of Dan Bossi if you have one, but I also want to ask you a question first, because on this program in January, February, and March, I vividly recall analysts saying, watch China, we think they might need to buy corn this year, but apparently not even the analysts believed it all the time. Why is that the case?
Well, I think when you go back at that particular time you mentioned about, I mean, everybody in the industry was wholly focused in a totally different direction, a.k.a. what impact was COVID going to have on the markets themselves? And, you know, we were firmly entrenched, at least in the early part of the decline we had in all the commodity markets, so to speak. And, you know, I think the whole China situation kind of got lost in that, because everybody was really looking, okay, how much negative impact is COVID going to have across the commodity sector here, even though we may have some things brewing out here in the distance, so to speak, as far as looking at commodity demand out of the U.S. per se. So I think that's why it kind of got lost. Back to Dan, you know, the one thing I keep thinking about, Dan, is as far as China is concerned, is looking at China, understanding the inventory of wheat the government owns. I haven't seen anything here in the last week as far as sales. But now that we've got corn prices basically up at or close to what wheat prices are in China, how aggressively is the Chinese government going to use this opportunity to pare down the wheat inventory that they own? And what kind of impact would that have back upon their corn import needs?
Well, I think it's a good question, Dale. I am hearing discussions in my commercial knitting groups that the Chinese may have bought some white wheat off the PNW because it is so cheap. So obviously the Chinese have this desire to feed, or maybe look at wheat as a feed ingredient. They did release some rice stocks, some old rice stocks and wheat stocks back in August, and it didn't really have an impact on the market. I mean, today we look at Chinese corn prices ex Dalian. We went above January futures at $10 and about 8 cents a bushel. So I'm not sure what it'll take to cool down the Chinese market. But as we stand back and look at the recovery of the hog numbers and, more importantly, their feed consumption, I believe in October we had a record use of feeding of corn and soybean meal within China. And we're only about maybe 70% back in terms of repopulating their hog herd. So, you know, if you think about this biosecure hog industry and the lack of, or let's say the changeover from backyard feeding to now corn and soy meal, it could be rather important. And that's why I keep thinking about this new demand driver that may be around for a couple of years.
Dave Chatterton, you have a question for Dan?
Yeah, thanks, Todd. Dan, I guess I'm curious about, let's cut right to South America and the soybean crop. I think if we're looking at things here, and, you know, the size of that crop is certainly something that's being debated here, and the rainfall and the conditions, et cetera. But I think alongside that, the timing of that crop is probably something that we should also discuss, and the fact that, you know, our sources down there indicate that the crop is very late. We've got China with a 6 million metric ton book of business out of China coming out in January and February that they may not be able to satisfy due to that lateness of that crop and just a late harvest, regardless of their crop size. And so with that, I guess I'm curious about your view on China's potential appetite during that period and what it's going to take to ration the U.S. Balance sheet to a position that allows us to maintain at least a pipeline carryout.
Yeah, we have Chinese imports now out of the United States, somewhere around 38 million metric tons. And with that, my soybean export estimate out of the U.S. is 2375. So I'm 175 million bushels above USDA, which gets our end stocks down to fumes or pipeline levels, if you will. A demand rationing move is needed here. But when I look at Mato Grosso and I talk to my office, and I was on a call with a 200,000-hectare co-op here this morning from Mato Grosso, I mean, this is now the driest September through the end of November, if I use the forecast for the next 10 days, that we have seen in 40 years. This is something you do not see in Mato Grosso, their biggest soy and corn production areas. And it's going to have an impact not only on their soybean crop, but really it's going to start to kick back the safrina. So our farm clients down there are already telling us we're not going to plant safrina because the soybeans are now just either coming up or still in the ground, and it doesn't give us a window. If you think about soybeans in Brazil, sometimes in the United States, we can have a 95 or 100-day bean. Down there, it's more like 105 to 110-day bean. So with that in mind, they're not going to make that cutoff date of around March 10th. So we think that it really impacts safrina as much as it does soybeans. But boy, the month of December is going to be so critical to get moisture across Mato Grosso with the low subsoil they now have. If it doesn't happen, these markets will get very heated very quickly.
Wayne Nelson, a question?
Yeah, Dan, you know, if we missed the China because of the COVID before and the distraction, is maybe are we centered too much on China now and COVID will come back with a vengeance and cut into some of the demand?
Well, Wayne, I really would like to believe that there's going to be a vaccine alternative sometime in the first quarter of next year that will get the economy at least trying to get some confidence again. If you notice, the stock market or the crude oil markets have not been declining with COVID cases rising. I think as you look at some of the data from Microsoft, where we look at miles driven, or at least for those of us with iPhones, the amount of travel that's going across, we're not seeing a big drop-off that we did back in April and May of last year. Now, this is not to say if the Biden administration comes in and puts a U.S. lockdown that that wouldn't have a negative impact. But at least today, at least in Chicago, I can tell you that even though the mayor is trying to shut down the city or tell us to stay home, very few people seem to be following it. And so I think the markets are trying to look beyond that and say, hey, there's a strong economic recovery coming if and when that vaccine gets distributed.
People haven't yet pulled back. At what point would COVID be bad enough for them to do that, and how much of an impact? Because it seems to me that that would be not just Chicago-centric, but across much of the United States, even if the lockdown isn't as great.
Yeah, I guess what we're talking about is the health system, and is the health system overrun in terms of hospital beds and ventilators and all those kind of things. And in some regions, that is happening. But I also believe that the millennials, if you will, or others believe that they're almost bulletproof to COVID and they're not going to pay much attention to it. So I think as we are up in years, as I am, we need to be protective of what's going on. But I can tell you in my own neighborhood here in Chicago, I would say half the homes have COVID now or did in the last week. It is spreading rapidly, but no one seems to be getting quite as ill as they might like to think. Now, again, if you're elderly and you've got conditions, I think that's another matter. But as I look around the northern part of Chicago, people are at least not in the same mindset they were back in April and May.
Let's turn our attention back to the rest of you. Dave Chatterton, as you listen to this conversation and you think about what farmers have left to sell for old crop corn and soybeans, what ideas do you have for them?
Yeah, Todd, at this point, I think there's a little bit of buyer's remorse, or seller's remorse, we should say, going on here with producers who had not recognized, as Dan led us into, how quickly the situation changed. If we go back and look, and even in, you know, let's say in June on the USDA, they had a 3.3 billion bushel carryout in corn. We're now at 1.7. In beans, they were at 610 million in August. We're now less than a third of that at 190. And this demand side has coupled up with a little bit of a loss on the supply side. So I think it's time to realize that things have changed. And for once, we're going to play a little bit of offense as opposed to defense. Cash basis levels have stayed relatively strong. We're seeing the river markets recover here a little bit. So it's a time not to be greedy, but based on what you have, I think it's time to think about if you don't have reownership against what you have sold, or at least a portion of that via options or via some kind of a paper strategy, it's probably time to think about incorporating that. That said, you know, not falling asleep at the switch here is going to be very important. We are at some levels that we haven't seen in a number of years. We're talking 4-year highs. We're talking values that have been, you know, like I said, we've been playing a lot of defense going back even into 2014, 15, and 16. So there are some opportunities here, but, you know, look at your profitability, know where you're at, manage your risk accordingly, and take advantage. We're keeping an eye on those 2021 values in terms of what they mean to your P&L and where your opportunities may be. I think a word of caution here for producers who have gotten used to or lulled to sleep in using premium contracts and accumulators and structured products, this is a time to probably pull back just a little bit and be aware that, you know, we're getting a few guys who are getting bit by those this year. I think there's the potential next year with poor weather, whether it be in South America or the U.S., to see that happen again. So keep that in mind as you go forward.
Wayne Nelson, I know there will be tax implications that producers likely can work through if they were to want to make additional sales this year, for instance, not waiting as long as they have confidence within their grain elevator system until January for payment. Should they do that at this time?
Well, I think that, Dave was saying, we have to look and see how much they sold ahead or what they have left to sell and what's going on. We see nothing wrong with selling 4-year highs to continue their marketing program and go along for cash flow differences. If they're worried about taxes, I think that we saw 2 or 3 different advisory firms that have put out in the last 2 months to buy fertilizer. Buy fertilizer, pay for it. And that'd take care of some of your tax implications on some of that. And we do think it is probably a good time, if you haven't already, to lock in a good portion of your fertilizer.
And Dale Durkles, I made $8 sales, I made $9 sales, I made $10 sales, didn't make any $11 sales, but I don't have any soybeans left. Should I do anything?
I think the one thing people need to start thinking about out there, you know, if they've already been pretty aggressive selling the 20 crops, is taking a look at the 21 crops. And, you know, I'm not saying you go in knee deep in the process at this point, but when you're working with November beans, 21, I'm speaking, trading 10 and a half, and you got December corn trading there a little over $4. That's really a good place people need to look at it, taking a start. And no matter what happens on the demand side for the crop we're currently dealing with here, you know, those new crop numbers out there for the 21 aren't going to get the carry off of whatever happens in the upfront scenario at this point. You know, those premiums will just continue to widen out, so you don't have the risk of making sales. You know, the other thing two things you've got to think about in that regard at this point, number one, assuming that we have something near a normal spring next year, you got an extra 7 to 8 million acres that you've got to figure out what is it going to get planted to, because a normal spring would suggest prevent plant numbers would be down around 2 million, maybe 3 million at most, but I'd say around 2. And the other process, when you look ahead to 21, you know, we had a bit of a problem here. We've had issues in Ukraine. We had issues in China. Now we're already building in some issues in South America. What are the odds of big production problems all coming at the same time again next year? And what kind of market impact are you going to have, or what kind of price structure are you going to have if, in fact, production comes back to a more normal relationship when we look at the 21 crops, not only here but around the world? And certainly you might look at current price levels and go, you know, I wish I'd have sold a lot more than I did.
Dan Bossy, when you look back at the spring of 2020 and you think about the impact of COVID-19 on ethanol usage, on the feed supply, on the livestock industry in particular, and here's where I'm thinking, is that you're telling me, you know, I think ethanol probably will be fine based on people's psychology this winter as it relates to COVID. However, if things are shut down, the one place that they can't go is to the restaurants. And I wonder if there are any lessons that you're satisfied were learned by the meatpacking industry that won't blow back into corn usage.
Well, it's always possible, Todd. The one thing that really surprised us about COVID, forget about the ethanol decline in spring, we were shocked that we think COVID really caused that 5 million drop, if you will, in U.S. corn plantings on the June report that was reflected back in prevent plantings last year. Mm-hmm. And then more importantly, as we went into the summer, both in May, June, July, August, and now September, domestic beef and pork demand in the United States was record large. So we were all thinking this food service industry wasn't going to be able, you know, take that out, and it's going to be devastating for the livestock industry. We all learned that we eat more red meat at home than we were eating outside the home. And so there will be these tremors, if you will, in the livestock futures or in the markets as we get plants maybe infected or workers can't debone and those kind of issues. But overall, we are really impressed with domestic meat demand, and I don't think that's going to change going forward here. I think everybody has learned that maybe for paying that same $35 and having a steak down at the restaurant, I can get 5 T-bones that I can cook for my family on Saturday night. So these are things that have changed, but I the big thing that sticks out on COVID is that domestic meat demand, just looking at not exports, but trade here, has been really, really strong. And I think that's one thing that'll get us through at least to a vaccine.
Dave Chatterton, across the planet, wheat, winter wheat in particular, in the Northern Hemisphere, even wheat in the Southern Hemisphere, has had a difficult season. Northern Hemisphere, of course, trying to get it into the ground under dry conditions, and the Western Hemisphere just suffering from La Nina, dry conditions there as well. What impact does that have on having the rest of the marketplace be able to follow along with it?
Well, Todd, it's the global commodity, but it's also much of a follower here, at least in terms of CBT futures and pricing right now. We've dipped that back below these $6 levels, at least on the front end of the market and in the front two contracts. And you know, the damage that's going to be done in South America, particularly to the Argentine wheat crop, probably done for the season. In the U.S., we're waiting, you know, we're going into dormancy here. We're going to have to wait and see how things come out again next spring. So it's certainly a part of the puzzle here. But when you look at the wheat situation in contrast to what we find with corn and beans and stocks-to-use ratio or ending stocks projections, I mean, wheat continues to be kind of the lead balloon, if you will. We've got a 42%, you know, stocks to use ratio here in the U.S., 44% globally, I believe, is the number. Those are not tight stocks. So wheat is a spreading opportunity here. I think we've seen that of late here in the last couple of trading sessions, or even the last couple of weeks, where we see, you know, the bigger funds and the spec players in the market that want to, I guess, look for that short leg, and wheat kind of tends to be that solution for them. So it's going to be a tougher haul here. I mean, we've seen some good prices. Hopefully producers have been paying attention to what those new crop, you know, July values have looked like. But I think wheat is still very much a follower here, Todd.
It sounds like a wet blanket as much as a follower, Dale Dirkles. Does it lay on the marketplace?
That's my attitude when I turn and I look at the wheat market at this point. I think it's somewhat of a wet blanket that the people in the corn trade that want to be wildly optimistic have to be worried about, especially, as I mentioned, you know, when you look at China, where you have corn prices in China internally up to the level wheat prices are in China itself, giving the government the opportunity to move stuff out. But here domestically, you got that same parameter at this point, because when you look back at wheat and corn, a lot of people continually lose sight about the fact it's corn is replaceable by wheat in a feed bunk. Corn is replaceable by wheat in the ethanol grind itself, or potentially so, either one of those. So unless the wheat market can continue to hold gains in here or find the energy to move higher, you know, it kind of puts a lid on the ability of the corn market to rally. So if the corn market's going to have a lot of upside potential left in it yet, the wheat market better start moving to get out of its way.
Earlier in the week, Wayne Nelson, NOPA, the National Oilseed Processors Association, released a really bullish usage number for crush, a record, in fact, domestically. How good was that for the marketplace, and how long can that last?
Well, it was tremendous. I mean, it really jumped things. You know, it shows with that crush that we need to somehow slow down demand to do that. Why, you know, we have to raise prices, and that's what we've been doing, trying to see if it can. But the meal demand has stayed very strong. Like we talked about the livestock before, we're continuing to keep the livestock prices pretty good. We're looking at people buying more beef and pork and eating at home even without the restaurant business, and we didn't think that would be happening. So, you know, the one thing that we have to look at is, you know, how much more beans the Soybean Export Council projected that China was going to, their demand for beans was going to grow 3% annually for the next 4 to 5 years. Are they going to continue to do that? And if so, along the way, and are we going to see them turn around and maybe start using some DDGs again? Because of tariffs and the tariffs that they had on, we were substituting a lot of bean meal or DDGs for their bean meal and a lot of their rations. Is that going to turn around, or will we get something new that they take the tariffs off those, or are they going to still stay with bean meal?
And Dan Bossi, you have to have both products being used in order to make the crush work properly, I believe. This week, Jerry Golke was on the program. He's been talking to some folks in North Dakota that say California's changed the way it's looking at biodiesel or diesel usage in general, and hoping to have more soybean or vegetable oil, more likely, in their mix. Is that likely to help make sure that those bean meal products go back into the rations rather than the DDGs from the corn?
I think that's possible. I think these are global markets these days, and I can't emphasize enough. When you look at vegetable oil prices, it's a sleeper in terms of bullishness. And I stand back and I look at the sunseed crop out of the Russia Black Sea area, and it'll be down 3 million metric tons. Palm oil production is declining because of old trees. Rapeseed oil is skyrocketed to record highs, as is canola. And so there's really this story going on about vegetable oils, which, along with the strong crush for meal, is going to make the crush margins very, very stout. Argentina today pulled out of the world soy oil market because it's exporting much of its soy oil production to Brazil for biodiesel. And so really the only place that vegetable oil buyers can turn to with a assured large supply is going to be the U.S. and principally in soybean oil. So the struggles that we have is trying to understand where the rationing is going to come from, because if crush margins stay strong, even with the problems in California, If we have, of course, our friends in Argentina continuing to rear back because of the peso and taxes and the inflation rate, it's a very difficult job to see how margins will collapse so that the crush margin or that crusher doesn't go forward with his expectation of processing beans.
Daryl Durkles, everything we've talked about suggests to me that the fundamentals that USDA will report in WASDE, probably in November, maybe in January, will have to be adjusted in some form. Where do you expect adjustments?
You know, when you step back from this thing and look at it, number one, I think the yield numbers, both corn and beans, could possibly come down a smidgen. We could have a little bit of reduction there. But when I step back and I start looking at the demand side of the mix at this juncture, where are you going to come up with it at? We're already at 2.6 billion bushel on corn exports, and, you know, we've got to prove this out. I think, you know, if we're going to follow a pattern in corn exports, when I look at what kind of pace do we see as we unfold through the marketing year, I think we've got to start looking back at maybe something like what we had in 15, 16. That's back-end loaded, but it's not necessarily guaranteed. Meanwhile, right now, we're not really exporting corn that aggressively. Beans themselves seem to be following a pattern we had in 16, 17 and hasn't really shown. And I'm looking at shipments. Hasn't shown a willingness to depart from that at this point. Everybody's looking at sales, and, yeah, we've still got – we're behind the USDA number as far as, you know, what they're projecting, and we still got more to sell yet. But sales can stop at any point. The real key to me at this early a time is we really need to start seeing shipments start to prove themselves out to really justify these big sales numbers we've got on the books. Just generalistically, when I look at a market today, you know, one old lesson, and it's both on the bull side and the bear side. When you look at a market at any given point in time, a bull market needs to be fed. And you know, as much as we've already built into this thing at this point, what new is going to come along to bring new buyers into the mix here at this point? And I'm not necessarily saying we've got a bear story. I just think for now, when I look at the game, that we've got a bull story that may have played itself out for now. And now we got a period where the market may have to sit back and start to go into an observational process. Do these markets really live up to our expectations? And I think with that, for now, we probably are at a point where we could see these rallies stall out for a while. And that certainly fits the cyclic parameters, too.
Dave Chatterton, your assessment?
Yeah, I'm not sure about the cyclical pattern of the market, but I guess I'd see it a little bit differently than Dan. I think in the situation that we're in right now and the speed of the change that's happened, we certainly have built a lot of this in. But a big part of this is the demand story that he talked about. And when we look at global stocks being depleted, you know, not only the domestic stocks inside of China, but also around in the global exporters, I'm not sure the market stays around and waits. If the weather continues to kind of go sideways in South America and they threaten that crop size and there's an issue here about who's going to fill that hole, we just don't have the beans at this point to fill that hole. I think corn is another issue where that balance sheet probably tightens up as well. And, you know, it's not as critically tight as what we see in soybeans by any means, but it does get down to a point that gets the market's attention. So I think the movement here, the big opportunities are probably between now and the South American harvest based on weather and based on filling what they can't fill of their early contracts. Beyond that, we're going to shift into more of a U.S. zone. But I think the market here is still on pretty stable footing. We do have some pretty good length in the fund side of the market, particularly in the soy side. But, you know, there's a lot of money on the sidelines here. There's been a lot of money injected around the world that needs to chase a return at some point. So I think those numbers could surprise us a little bit going forward. So maybe just a little bit different viewpoint than maybe what Dale had.
Wayne, combining Dave and Dale just a little bit on soybean. We talked about the gap that needed to be filled because of the late planting season. The South Americans caught up on their planting now. And we may or may not have a weather problem there at this point because it's so early in the season. What are the possibilities or potentials and the pitfalls?
Well, the one thing we can look at is, like you say, they have caught up. They have time for their beans to finish. The problem with the early planting's not happening was really the safrina crop corn. It wasn't the beans themselves. We have you know, beans like dry feet early, and they like the moisture to fill in their last, you know, 6 weeks. So we've got plenty of time to make a good bean crop down there. It just might be the shortness of the safrina crop is more what we're looking at as far as that goes. So I'm not selling their first bean crop short. We've got a couple extra weeks. Well, I think with all of the bean shipments that China's been taking, if they really see a good bean crop coming on, they might slow down. We might not really get those extra couple of weeks because I don't think they'll need beans immediately. So I don't know. I'd sort of like to ask Dan, do you have points moving on up here, or the chart points, or just places where you feel just it's time to sell something because it's a level we haven't seen in a long time for farmers?
Well, I think there's those kind of points. I mean, $12 stands out, the 2016 high. If you get above that, I know our work would talk about $14 to $16. You know, as I stand back from it all and do my modeling, I look at world G3, which is Argentina, Brazil, and the United States combined. Even without weather problems, I got stock use ratios in beans now down at their lowest levels in 23 years. And so there is this dynamism to the market with the problems in the United States and Black Sea in terms of minor oil seeds. If you were to have the accentuation of the Mato Grosso dryness or those kind of things, and I know you talk about farmers catching up in seedings in Mato Grosso and throughout Brazil, but I've got clients that have planted beans three times down there and the beans still aren't up. I mean, they caught up, but it's not what they were looking for. And so we've been cutting our Brazilian crop going forward. And then I would throw out to the group it saying, you know, we all didn't expect that, or at least I'll put my camp in here. I didn't expect that China would take $30 billion of U.S. commodities this year. I was kind of poo-pooing and playing that down. What happens next year if they really are intent on taking 43 and a half? And what does that do for longer term? I have a problem. I don't think these markets will relax until probably the spring of next year once we get U.S. crop in the ground.
I'll take a moment here and suggest that everybody listening, if you've not used the closing market report and listened to the weather segment, there are five of the best agricultural meteorologists on the planet that we talked with, one each day of the week and all winter long, actually starting when they begin to plant in mid-September through the time that they're finished harvest on second crop in July. We follow those crops in Brazil, Argentina, Paraguay, Uruguay very, very closely. The weather guys do, and they are worth listening to. Now, let's check in on a final word from each of you. I think Wayne Nelson from L&M Commodities in Newmarket, Indiana. We'll start with you today.
Well, Goldman Sachs came out and said there's going to be a bull market in raw commodities to hedge against inflation. And they didn't really include grains with that, but I think they are somewhat included. And I do think that that's going to draw some other money into this to come in, because Goldman Sachs hits a different group than commodity trader, than corn and bean traders as general. So I think that a lot of the things they're saying is, that Dan mentioned, that other people and other money out there could be coming into this. So that is one of the things that could be very good. Another thing just to add in here, seasonally, corn tends to strengthen in early January while beans firm through the end of December. And that has been worked for 13 out of 15 years with corn and 14 out of 15 years with beans. So unless we do counter-seasonal here, we still got a little ways to go.
Dave Chatterton from Strategic Farm Marketing in Champaign, your final word.
Yeah, thanks, Todd. So great discussion. And I think, you know, when I look at where we're at from our particular view from our group, we are bullish that Chinese demand, and we've talked about that to some degree here on the call. We're also concerned with the South American weather, and I think Dan did a good job of pointing that out. The planting progress numbers there don't necessarily tell the true story of a crop that's been replanted and that's struggling to emerge and with its early growth and production. And so with that, I think these markets remain well supported here and create some opportunities for us that we haven't seen in the recent years. That doesn't mean prices can't go down, things can't correct. COVID is definitely a wild card here. But I guess the message I'd send to producers, we've talked a lot about marketing and different things here on the call, but a very practical thing is that I think there's the potential for some early premiums next year. So producers, if you could get ready to plant beans early, perhaps even before corn in a lot of cases, get your corn out early. Some of those early premiums in August and September may be there if we're in a very tight market globally here and looking for exports to hit the water. So just something to keep in mind going forward.
Dale Durkles from Grain Cycles in Normal, Illinois.
You know, if there was ever a year that people could appreciate the importance of price cycles and and what they tell you, it was 2020. And the reason I say that, we were due for a 5.5 year corn low. We were due for a 2 year low in the corn market. 5.5 came with the April low and came with all the right emotions to have a bottom in a bear market. The 2 year low the same in August, where we had people still thinking at that point, you know, about big corn crop, that people weren't looking around and watching the weather. Beans, we had a 2 year and a 3 year low both due here in this calendar year as well. So understanding those long-term price cycles really does give you a bit of help to understand things that are going on. We were also in a window due for a 3 year low in commodity indices at the same juncture. The only problem I have at this particular point in looking at things optimistically is I think the markets, and looking at some of the shorter term cycles that I look at in corn and beans and even in commodity indices, tell me we need to be kind of careful. We may have reached a level where these markets might take a pause. And I'm not saying they're going to break a whole lot, but I think the upward momentum might tend to stall here for a while, and that'll catch people off guard. So, you know, you want to be wary. Like I said earlier, a bull market continues to need new fuel. And right now I look around and I go, where's that going to come from? And I'm not sure I can see it.
And Dan Bossi from Ag Resource Company. Dan, by the way, thank you for joining us today.
Oh, it's been a pleasure, Todd. And it's a little different market than we've been in for many, many years, going all the way back to 2012. We do have this new demand driver as China's come. And to Dale's point, if we don't have a weather problem in South America, we could go sideways here for a while. But I want everybody to understand, if we don't get the rains and Mato Grosso continues to be in this arid pattern, I do think December will be a very exciting month heading into the end of the year. We also need to buy another 7 or 8 million acres of soybeans for next year. And even my balance sheet then will only be marginally above 150 million bushels. And so this is a time frame where we can be bullish, a little more bullish, for probably 18 months and find your marketing spots, find places that will work for you. But maybe this is also a time you want to be a little protective of upside risk should it occur.
Commodity Week is a production of Illinois Public Media. You can find and listen to the whole of the program, our daily closing market report program as well, on our website at willag.org, W-I-L-L-A-G.org. Our thanks go to our panelists this week, including Dan Bossi, Dave Chatterton, Dale Durkles, and Wayne Nelson. I'm Illinois Extension's Todd Gleason.